So why mentioning these and not mentioning child pornography or trafficking of people and any other many other evils? That, I mean, why these? Is this the? I mean, what? For purposes of the prevention, investigation, proof of offense, prosecution of offenders, and execution of sentences. So, are they doing, and this is the difficulty that we need to accept, are they telling us that they are gathering information for purposes which go beyond the prevention, investigation, proof of offense, prosecution of offenders, and the execution of sentences or security measures? If that's what they're doing, they shouldn't be doing it.
Doing, and I think that is legitimate detection.
Gee, that's spot on. And you will note in our existing Roman 2, we didn't insert the word detection. We wanted to propose from our side that we should insert detection because it runs through other portions of the bill as well. But their concern was specifically expressed that if you look at the processing of personal information, what they actually do is they don't investigate the crime. They process the information, for example, and forward it onwards to SAPS. We ask them the same questions that we are being asked here now, but they felt, and with specific reference then to Roman 2, that even if the word detection is inserted, they would prefer that it be further defined to ensure that their activities, as far as the processing of that type of information is concerned, is not is excluded from the provisions of the Act. We wanted to propose, in any event, aside of this, that we should insert detection in Roman 2.
Well, Mr. Chairman, sorry, can somebody help me? Why should they, I accept that they collect all this information, but why should they be exempted from the obligation of dealing with them properly and in the same way as you and I do, and not leaking them out? Why should they give our information to somebody else other than SAPS? They are protected when they do it to SAPS, but here we would be exempting them from taking the very measures of due diligence which would prevent the same information to go for other purposes.
Been established in specific legislation for the protection of such personal information. I think
what they probably want
to do is avoid a conflict of laws.
No, that doesn't, because if the proviso kicks in, then the exemption kicks in. So it's not
If they can argue that there are adequate safeguards in the FICA Act, for example,
Yeah. They
would want to then say that this activity, this collection of information, should not apply to this law. So you don't have a problem of a conflict of laws, which you apply FICA or this one.
Yeah, but that would remain, because FICA would continue to apply. I mean, this is just
they don't want this law to apply to the issue of the conflict of laws.
The proviso applies, and even in this case, they are not exempted. They are exempted only to the extent that the proviso.
If they've got adequate safeguards in FICA,
Yes. This
law will not apply.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and
but
that's what they want.
Yeah, but that's the way it is. It's irrespective of whether or not we add this language.
No, there's no other. There's no other exclusion clause. It's only if.
Okay, take the language out. The underlying language app. They are subjected to it. To the extent they are subjected to the extent and they're only exempted to the extent that FICA applies. If FICA doesn't apply, they are not exempted.
Okay.
Am I being clear?
The problem that they would have is, I think, with one, although you could argue that these activities aimed at assisting in the identification of the financing of terrorists and related activities could be covered under national security defense or public safety, they wanted put in specifically that if they are involved in these activities and they've got the anti-terrorist legislation or whatever it is, then that law applies. It's the safeguards, the argument. They would have to argue that those safeguards are adequate, and if they succeed, that law then applies, not this one, and it's clear cut. Similarly with this one, with two, that as far as detection of money laundering activities, they want to make it clearer cut. I mean, look, I don't know if Dr. Ambrosini and I would ever be in agreement. I think it should be, I don't know if the discussion is taking it any further. Let's put it in as an option. Okay. The other one that they had then is Clause 11, but we'll carry on with Clause, what are we on, Clause 4. Then we've got the famous journalist clause. You produced an Annexure A. I'm not sure if that's an under or Henk or both or Henk, okay? Do you want to just take it to Annexure A? Does everybody have Annexure A? It was sent out to you before.
No, it's the one we have in front of us. It's option one and option two.
It's Annexure A, Protection of Personal Information Exclusion for Exclusively Journalistic Purposes. And it is 15 pages with a chart at the back with the Canadians and the Australians and everything else. If you've got two copies, can you give Mario one? And then I don't know if...
No.
If neither of them is here. Yeah, but can we... check who's got the document or who doesn't have the document. Mr. Lange, have you got the document?
At PMG, not
at
here.
PMG. and then can, Henk, are you going to take us through it?
Okay, I'll just go through it. Look, we have the existing paragraph D, that's paragraph 1.1, existing paragraph D, which provides for the exclusive journalistic purposes by responsible parties who are subject to, by virtue of office, employment, or profession, a code of ethics that provides adequate safeguards for the protection of personal information. During the public hearings, we had different people coming to Parliament making submissions. I think what one should immediately recognize is that some of the arguments that were made there were just not in accordance with the Act. What happened is that submissions were made as if in the submissions the qualifications, the exceptions in the principles were not taken into account. Had the effect that a lot of unintended consequences, as they were called, were identified, which is in fact not, that is not just not factual. This is just something that one must keep into consideration, because if one has the opportunity to have a discussion with them, we may have been able to, for them to note the fact that they were actually not taking all of the sections of the bill into consideration in making their arguments. What is important also is that one should distinguish clearly between, and that's paragraph 1.3, between the ordinary business and administrative activities of institutions engaged in journalistic activities on the one hand, and then the professional work done by the journalists for these institutions. The first one will always be subject to the bill anyway. It is only when it is done, when we're talking about the professional work done by the journalists, that the exclusion comes in. And then also, the exclusion as it is at the moment in the bill, and we have kept it in this way for, in the options that we've provided today, is also that it is only for people who are actually in a sort of structured situation where they have codes of conduct by virtue of office employment or profession. So you wouldn't be talking about a blogger or somebody like that who may also be engaging in journalistic activities, but who will not be included in the Act. So that is, one should just realize that who you are actually talking about. Now, in this MHRA, we looked at various aspects. First of all, the right to freedom of expression and the right to privacy, the nature of our legislation, the information protection principles, self-regulation, adequate safeguards, EU adequacy, international examples, and then whistleblowers. I'm not going to go into all of that because some of it we have discussed already. I think what is just important to note is that the bill, as even the section that we, the original section, did not attempt to change the position regarding the freedom of expression or the right to media freedom or the right to of the public to be informed. We were just trying to incorporate those existing principles into the legislation. So, you know, I think that there's also a misconception in the sense that they feel that the journalists may have felt that we are trying to put stringent, more stringent provisions in place. That was not the idea. So the right to freedom of expression, we acknowledge the fact that there was a balance between, there should be a balance between the freedom of expression and the right to privacy, and the existing court cases and all of the other international principles regarding that balance, it was actually, we tried to, of course, call you to take that into to consideration. The nature of principle-based legislation, we have now, we know what principle-based legislation is. I think it's just important to note that, you know, the one principle, for example, in 3.4, principle 7 of the bill, deals with data security. Now, the same principle provision will be applicable to people from a wide range of institutions, for example, a primary school teacher and banking institutions. It will mean something different for a primary school teacher than it will for a banking institution, and the rule in each case will be different. That is why we actually talk about principle legislation, because we don't have a specific rule for school teachers and a specific rule for banking institutions. We just have one principle that can be applied to both instances. And in terms of that, we, you know, that is what we tried to do. That is why we haven't provide for specific rules. And the idea is that the journalists had to provide the outcome, get to the outcome themselves. They were supposed to draw up the code of ethics in terms of the safeguards that were provided. I think in Annexure A, what happened in this on page 5 and further is that we looked at each principle and showed, and actually tried to show, if you have a correct reading of the principles and you incorporate the exceptions in each instance, what the effect would be. In 4.5, paragraph 4.5 on page 5, we looked at principle 1. The responsible party must ensure that the principles are complied with. That's no problem. Then principle 2, personal information must be processed lawfully and in a reasonable manner. Consent is not the only requirement. What they said is that they would need the consent of each person about whom they are writing something, you know, which is not the case because consent is not the only requirement in principle 2, but it's merely one of 6 possible options prescribed for processing in clause 10. And option 6, for example, provides that personal information may also be processed without consent where the processing is necessary for pursuing the legitimate interests of the responsible party or of a third party to whom the information is supplied. That's clause 10.1f. Journalism is certainly a legitimate interest and press freedom is protected in the Constitution. So this law provision is only subject to one qualification that's reflected in clause 10.2, namely that the data subject may object to the processing if objection is on reasonable grounds and in a prescribed manner. This is in accordance with the current position where any person who is subject of a newspaper article may approach the press ombudsman or even take the newspaper to court if offended. Now, that specific example comes from the EU directive, where they explain how Clause 10.2 should be interpreted. So it's not as if you need the consent of each person as they proclaimed. It is not the case at all. Principle 3, clause 12 of the bill, provides that personal information must be collected for specific lawful purpose related to the activity. As a general rule, data subjects must be made aware of the purpose of the collection. Again, this is not necessary where compliance with clause 13 would prejudice the lawful purpose of the collection or would not be reasonably practicable in the circumstances of a particular case, or where the information will be used for historical, statistical, or research purposes. So these provisions are actually self-explanatory, and it is unfortunate that they did not, in the submissions, these qualifications were not discussed to see what the impact factor would have been on position. Clause 14 provides that personal information must also not be retained for any longer that's required for achieving the purpose for which it was collected. Now, that was also something that they raised, in that they would not be able to collect the information, but insofar as journalists are concerned, one may argue that personal information may be kept indefinitely, as is the case with archives for research purposes. Now, principle 4 is further personal processing of personal information must be compatible with the purpose for which it was collected. The journalist may only use the information collected for the purpose compatible with journalistic purposes, and so forth. I don't know if you want me to go through the principles in this way, but each principle can actually be explained in the way that it has been dealt with. Insofar as special personal information is concerned, it provides that there's a prohibition. It also comes from the EU directive, which states that you may not process personal information where it's the religious, philosophical beliefs, race, ethnic origin, etc. But once again, you have the exemption, the public interest exemption in 32B, which says that you can do it if it's necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or obligation in law. Now, since the right of freedom of expression and express freedom is protected in the Constitution, it's implicit that this exemption will apply. And then the other thing that was also mentioned was that, there will be censorship in the sense that they would have to ask the regulator every time that they want to use the process, the information of religion or race or ethnic or whatever information, but that would also be covered by the fact that an exemption by the regulator is a once-off exemption. So it is not the case that you would go to the regulator in each specific instance where you need an exemption. A responsible party who needs exemption from a specific principle to be able to do their work will ask that on a once-off basis, should it be necessary. However, that is not taking into consideration the exceptions that are already set out in the different principles. That even if a principle with the exception is still making it difficult to do the work, then they could go to the regulator and get a once-off exemption of that principle, and that would cover them for the next 100 years. Insofar as self-regulation, what was the attempt in the bill was that they would actually be subject to the bill, but that one would make provision for self-regulation. That has happened in Australia. And of all the countries in the world, Australia was the only one which we could find where the press association was actually happy with the way in which they were being dealt with because of the fact that there was self-regulation in place. The effect of the self-regulation for journalistic activities as distinguished from all the other activities would be the following. And that's on page 9A, where the responsible party is subject to a code of ethics providing adequate safeguards as required in terms of clause 4D of the bill, the act will not be applicable at all. The drafting of the code will be an internal matter and does not have to be signed off or approved by the regulator, so the journalists will be able to decide themselves what the code would what the content would be. The regulator will have no jurisdiction over the professional lives of journalists. Should the regulator receive a complaint from a data subject, the regulator can only determine whether the code of contains adequate safeguards. If this is the case, the data subject will be referred back to the sector adjudicator. This must be distinguished from the ordinary position in the bill where we talk about industry-specific codes of conduct, because with ordinary codes of conduct, the Act will still be applicable, And this is also the position in the UK, where they also have code of conduct, but the Act is still applicable, so you still have notification and all of the other. The drafting of the codes are regulated through a prescribed process, and approved codes can be withdrawn or re-evaluated by the regulator. And a sector-specific adjudicator can deal with complaints. However, the data subject within the normal course has the right of appeal to the regulator, who will have the ultimate say. So giving them this in the exclusion, the ability to draw up their own code, was actually an attempt to give them self-regulation and would be put them in a much better position than the ordinary responsible party would be, also gets a code of conduct. It should also be noted that the fact that the bill is based on the regulatory model was canvassed and supported by the majority of stakeholders. No other responsible party in the private sector has received self-regulatory or co-regulatory status, and it was therefore regarded as the broadest and most unrestricted possible exemption that could be provided. Then we go to the adequacy, EU adequacy safeguards, because that is also important. The EU makes provision for an exclusion from the principles. However, the provision is that you can never exempt someone from the security principle, and there should also be ex post facto powers for the regulator. That's in general what the EU says. There are quite a number of they talk about it quite a lot in the EU. It says that member states shall provide for exemptions or derogations for the purpose of artistic or literary expression only if they are necessary to reconcile the right to privacy with the rules governing freedom of expression. And then they explain a little bit what that reconciliation should be about. It says that data protection law, the EU Article 29 Working Party in its recommendation stated as follows. They said that data protection law does in principle apply to the media, and that the exemptions, that's what I've just said, no exemption for security, and they must retain certain ex post facto powers. The derogations and exemptions must also follow the principle of proportionality. Now, that's very important, because the derogations, what they call exceptions in our bill, must be granted only in relation to the provisions likely to jeopardize freedom of expression and only insofar as necessary for the effective exercise of that right while maintaining a balance with the right to privacy. So if you have many exceptions in your principles like we do, then your exclusion should be less. You can't give a big derogation or a huge derogation if you have the exceptions already. So the balance have already been struck in the principles themselves, and then it's not really necessary to give the exclusion. But we have done both anyway. So even if we had not had any exclusion in Clause 4, the exceptions in the principles would already have been enough to guarantee the press freedom that is in place at the moment. There are quite a number of things that they deal with, but I'm not going to go into that. International examples, most countries provide for exemptions for journalistic purposes. However, there are no blanket exemptions in legislation that has received EU adequacy status. Europe, Belgium, Spain, and Portugal have no express exemption for the media. Sweden, Germany, France, Netherlands, United Kingdom, Austria, and Finland, the media are exempted from the application of some or several provisions of the data protection. As I said, no blanket exemptions exist. Insofar as OECD countries are concerned, it should be noted that their legislation is based on the OECD guidelines, which only provide for exceptions to privacy principles to be limited to those necessary in a democratic society. So they don't refer to journalists specifically, but I think that would be included in there. And then I've already mentioned that the bill follows the Australian example, which seems to be working well in practice. It has, however, the Australian Law Reform Commission has criticized it as being too broad, and they recommended in 2009 that the exclusion be amended to make provision for the development and publication of criteria for adequate media privacy standards and a template for media privacy standards that may be adopted by media organizations. So they also indicated, although the press was quite happy with this, the Law Reform Commission said that it wasn't clear what adequate media privacy standards were and that should be tightened. And they indicated that the criteria must be developed by the Office of the Privacy Commissioner in consultation with the Australian Communications and Media Authority and peak media representative bodies. However, they did not draft any legislation. They just made this recommendation. In Canada, we do find that PEDA, the Personal Information Protection Electronic Documents Act, contains a wide exemption. But one should remember that in Canada, that act only applies to private sector organizations that collect, use, or disclose personal information in the course of commercial activities. So the professional component of journalistic processing for journalistic purposes are excluded from that act, so that isn't helpful. Then there's just a little bit on the whistleblowers, because I know that there were concerns, some submissions were made that the whistleblowers and other confidential informants fall within the scope, you know, also will also be dealt with in this paragraph. And it is true that it will they will be dealt with by the scope of the bill, but not within the ambit of this discussion, because the purpose for which journalists collect information is journalism, and they may not use it for another purpose. The position regarding whistleblowers is regulated from their perspective and not from the perspective of the journalist. So given the purpose of the reporting system for whistleblowers is to ensure proper corporate governance, the data collected and processed through a reporting scheme should be limited to facts related to this purpose. So it's not actually dealt with in this particular exclusion. Companies setting up these systems should therefore clearly define the type of information to be disclosed through the system. The personal data processed within the scheme should be limited to the data strictly and objectively necessary to verify the allegations made. In addition, complaint reports should be kept separate from other personal data. So, yes, whistleblowers are being dealt with in this act, but it's not a concern of this specific section that we're dealing with. So in the conclusion, we said that the following possibilities for dealing with the processing of personal information for exclusively journalistic purposes have been identified. One could either have a completely unqualified exclusion, that is what the journalists asked for in their submission. Secondly, an exclusion for journalists to the extent that they are subject to code of conduct. This would amount to no additional exclusion being necessary. Thirdly, an exemption from certain of the data protection principles. That is the way that they deal with it, for instance, in the UK and also in the Netherlands. But it is very restrictive because they don't exclude many of the principles. And then D, an exclusion amounting to self-regulation as suggested in the bill, but subject to the development of criteria to determine the ambit of the safeguards provided for in the exclusion. I think one of the options that we've put forward today tries to do that. Now, it's just a quick discussion of each of the options. A blanket exclusion would be contrary to the provisions of the EU directive and would complicate South Africa's adequacy status. It is not in accordance with international best practice. You don't find it anywhere in the world. There also seems to be no reason why journalists should not be subject to obligations to keep information safe, not to sell it for direct marketing purposes, to attempt to ensure the quality of the information, etc. And these principles should not be negotiable. So that would be the effect of a blanket exclusion. Then making journalists subject to the ordinary provisions of the bill regarding codes of conduct may send the message that freedom of expression has not been adequately considered in drafting the bill. I must say, in the original draft that was circulated for comment, there was no exclusion for journalists, and it was included for the reason that the Law Commission felt that the freedom of expression should be acknowledged. Then the third one, an exemption from certain data protection principles will be in accordance with the position in most countries. It will, however, one should recognize that it will be a much stricter provision than the current provision, since the Act will still be applicable in all respects except for those provisions that have specifically been excluded, and the regulator will still have jurisdiction. That is more or less the UK position and the Netherlands as well. Should this be the option chosen, it requires a tailored partial exemption only from the collection, use, and disclosure, as well as access and correction principles. In this regard, it appears that there is no reason why the media should not be subject to the same obligation as other businesses in relation to data quality and security, overall transparency, and overseas transfer. The exemption should also only apply to genuine news and current affairs role of the media. Then the final option, that addresses the only real valid concern that was raised, namely that it's not clear what the criteria would be for determining adequate safeguards. In terms of this option, this statement was made because of the fact that some of the concerns raised was based on incorrect information or incorrect reading of the bill. In terms of this option, the exclusion will stay as is, but a sub-clause could be included in Clause 4 to indicate that criteria must be developed by the Information Protection Regulator in consultation with peak media representative bodies and the public to determine what safeguards would be regarded as being adequate. Once this question has been settled, the media organizations would be left to self-regulate and the Act will not be applicable to them anymore.
Clarity before I give Dr. Ambrosini. You've then, in terms of the document you gave us this morning, put out three options, which then deal with those aspects, the existing D, option one, option two, and option three. Mario.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that Ananda is correct in her analysis of the bill. And I wish we had, we have taped, what she said has been taped. I wish we had the opportunity of transcribing it. And then we can give it to all the journalists who write articles between 3 and 5 o'clock to meet the deadline. The difficulty that I have, again, I might be a traditionalist, but when we talk about freedom of speech and freedom of the media, we all become aware of what's called the chilling effect. And our traditional training is that of doing nothing which can chill the freedom of the media. Even though there is nothing in the law which has the power to inhibit that freedom, the perception, the understanding of what the law could do or could not do, for all those who will not have the benefit of having read, fully understood, and internalized the analysis that Ananda has given us during the last half an hour, will have that impact. And will have the impact as people complain about what the media writes, as people trying to get gagging orders, as people write later, don't publish because you do. We all know that the business of journalists is individual. It's not the newspaper. It's the single guy at the single desk with his data bank, with his information, with his numbers, with all that. So in the end, in real life, the data processor is not the newspaper. It's the single journalist. And that puts, both in respect of those who work for a newspaper, those who are freelancers. What does that translate to, Mr. Chairman? I think you need to give us the guidance on this one and see where. I mean, both Dean and I have been very open in expressing where we come from, and I, for one, would be very interested in finding out where you come from.
May I just perhaps reiterate the EU directive does give, Article 9 does give, as indeed Ananda has said, it does provide for exemptions and derogations for journalistic purposes. But, you know, all right, that's fine as far as we're supposed to be compliant, but I don't imagine that compliance with their journalistic standards is now really the most important aspect of what we're doing here. On our side, we have constitutionalized media freedom to a degree matched only by Germany. As far as I'm aware, we've explicitly constitutionalized it. The one thing we've always observed in this country is you never go anywhere near content. The broadcasting media have a regulator for one single purpose, and it's technological. It's because of frequency scarcity. Were it not for that, there would be no regulator to give out the licenses. And when you give out your licenses, you can look at what is called content only in the broadest sense, what kind of a TV station or radio. Never, ever will the regulator there intrude on the actual content of actual reportage or journalism. And I am not able to go to a place where I allow a regulator to keep an eye or to regulate in any form or shape the actual content of journalistic output. And therefore, it remains my position that we should take the formulation that says that the processing of information by any person of any journalistic, literary, or artistic material is excluded. And I thought I could just add, I mean, one could go, for the sake of now of compliance, one could go for the minimum exemption and derogation, and maybe say exempt journalists from all the principles except your data security, your technical one. That's what the British one does, the UK. But then it has a lot of other provisions that I don't like. The UK one, which I thought Mr. Jeffries earlier said would be is part of his position, and in respect of which SANEF has also indicated that they might not be too miserable with that. But you know, you look at that, and I don't like that either. That's the one that says journalism is exempt from all the principles except security. It's exempt from the UK Act's provisions on subject access, the preventing of processing, as you can imagine, automated decision-making, rectification and blocking, as you can imagine, because all of that would amount to a right to censorship by the data subject. But it leaves things in, which I find very difficult. It remains possible for the regulator under the UK Section 44, 45, 46 to receive a request based on reasonable grounds for suspecting that personal data are not being processed only for the special purposes, i.e. journalistic purposes. So somebody can trot off to this office and say, you know, what these people are doing is not really journalism. And that regulator can then inspect this lot. And all of which smacks to me of prior restraint, which we have by now enough case law as well as constitutional provisions to make it quite clear that we don't tolerate such a thing. And so, you know, I mean, I just don't want to do this thing. I think it should be a complete exclusion. And if you want to do some sort of absolutely minimal thing, why don't we say, give a provision for journalism and say they are exempt from all principles except security one.
In clarification or correction, when Ananda says no country of the world does, it's correct and incorrect. I mean, I'm saying this to be tested. I don't know of any similar principle even remotely applying in the United States, but she's correct because the United States, there is no such legislation. So if there is no legislation, there is no exemption. But I don't know. I would find it an impossibility for any of these things to be imposed on a culture like the United States where there is freedom of journalism entrenched. And I wouldn't be the one who is seen, who is going to be seen by journalists that trying to abridge their freedom. What is your position, Mr. Chairman? Can we go and say that you are the one who will do that?
I mean, look, I mean, there isn't an ANC position. I mean, we would have to put things before the committee. There seem to be two positions being put here. I mean, you and Dean seem to be in favor of the exemption of finding first of any journalistic material or article material. Which, now, my question would be, Ananda, you say that that's blanket exemption and it wouldn't conform to the EU principles. But is that not exactly what Canada is for? Because they, personal information that organizes state media discloses the journalistic article for military purposes and does not collect news or disclose to any other person. Is that not what Canada are largely saying? Having said that, though, I noticed that both Canada and Australia refer to this exemption applies to organizations. It does not, from the extract you've given us, it does not apply to individuals. The canon is this part does not apply to any organization. just get an exemption for everybody. Like any person, any journalist, if you are like a secretary. And if you have that exemption, what's the point of the act? So, I mean, the whole thing has been towards self-regulation, which is what was originally in the bill and what for the new 4A goes for, just giving greater clarity. But if you have in option 2, which is the plus Ambassini, Ariane Ambassini option, you haven't been put in such a huge hole in the act that anyone could come in.
No, I think that you ought not to worry about that, because the essential problem is that an act like this is so ill-suited to journalism as an endeavour. It just doesn't fit. And if you remember, the British commissioner said no when asked by us. He said no, they have certainly never done anything in respect of the media. And whether they said so in so many words, I think. I mean, nor were they likely to. It's just not what they're really there for. This statute is not really there for journalism. It's there for the people who collect information for other purposes.
The issue is not the media. The issue is people then using the section because it is so wide. Any person of any journalistic history will ask for the material. The intention might be for it to cover the media only. But the clause is it can cover anyone.
The way this act works, it doesn't cover people, or doesn't exempt people. It covers activities. So what would be exempted here are not the journalist, but the journalistic activity, not the entity. So if the journalist sells bank accounts to the fraudster or to anyone else, in so doing, would not be acting as a journalist or for journalistic purposes. If he publishes those bank accounts on the newspapers to identify all the bank accounts on which allegedly fraudulent transactions have taken place by the action of somebody who is in the public interest on the public figure, then it's a different story. But my point is that I, in developing these options, I appreciate the development, but I feel a little taken aback because the option that I put forward has not been listed as an option, and I'm not saying it's necessarily the preferable one, but it is an option. And as I apply my mind, I still believe that it should be at least my preferable option, which read a disclusion. And the purpose, for any purpose, because we're excluding purposes, for any purpose, embodying the exercise of a right protected under the Constitution, including but not limited to journalistic purposes. I would be satisfied with that. Because why the journalist? Because they've got the freedom of the media. Why the freedom of the media? Because it's protected under the Constitution. And what about the rest? So for any, it is purpose. So when we're dealing with trade unions, We are not exempting the trade union. But if there are certain activity within the trade union, is the freedom of trade union, which activity is protected in the Constitution, then the bill cannot apply. If there are certain activities within the activities of political parties, the canvassing, you need to get the names of the people. You need to, if you need to have those phone numbers to make those calls at the last moment, that is an exercise under the Constitution. It's exempted. It's the purpose and the activity. And it's not the political party. And I do accept that Ananda will come back and will identify a sub-item and a sub-subsection where all these things are taken care of because of purposes. And I accept that that might be the case. But again, the chilling aspect, and we cannot run a legal analysis of situations like this when we are in the exercise of constitutional rights. So I would like for this option at least to be tabled.
You're assuming that because it's an organization that there are restraints built in?
Yes.
I think I just want, like to comment on the position of Canada. What one must remember is in Canada, Canada is closer to America than to Europe in the way that they deal with the privacy. So they have an act, but they have an act for the government. Then they have an act prepared in which this exemption is contained that only deals with commercial activities. So it's not a general act. So if they exclude it from that act, there's actually no act in Canada that deals with what would have been journalistic activity from which you could have excluded it. Because that act only deals with commercial activities, and as we said right at the start, any newspaper has commercial activities which would anyway be dealt with in this act. So Canada is not a good example of a country that has a blanket exemption anyway, whichever way it's phrased, because they're not doing what we are really talking about. It's outside the ambit of our discussion. Insofar as the organization aspect is concerned, is that what we try to incorporate also the idea for organization in the current D is that it had to be a responsible party who are subject to by virtue of office, employment, or profession, a code of ethics. So that was where the safeguard actually came in, because that would more or less be an organization. It wouldn't be somebody who won't have a code of ethics just for yourself or whatever. So that is. So we also actually refer to that. And then just the final thing is, what I think what's very important, and this is insofar as the whole act is concerned, is the act is not meant to stop the flow of information. So in that same vein, the act is not meant to stop journalists from doing their work. It is just regulating the process. It's also not about the content of what they are writing. It is the process which they use when writing about personal information. And anyway, if they have that code of ethics with the adequate safeguards, this act will not apply to them at all. Whereas if we have this suggestion where the security principle is, give them exemption except for the security principle, the Act will still apply, because how are you going to implement the principle number 7 if the Act doesn't apply? So they will still have to notify, they will still be subject to the regulator to come into their offices to have a look to see how they are securing the information, etc. Whereas that is why I'm saying what we tried to do was give them the absolute best possible situation that they could possibly ask for, because once they were excluded from the Act, they would never talk to the regulator again.
The code has to be commensurate with the Act.
The idea behind that was it must be commensurate with the Act, but the Act is already a balanced Act. So the expression and the freedom has already been balanced, so it would not impact on the activities at all.
I really would like to call attention, Mr. Nanda, if you can, through you, Mr. Chairman, focus on this difficulty I have. Journalism is journalists. There are no journalists in here, but it's a single journalist. Yeah, there may be a morgue where they get the information, etc., but the data bank is usually the individual. And this is what is critical, especially the freelancers. It's a one man or one woman show. There was another point I'll come back when I remember.
I was going to try and finish short four, but I one of these sort of vaguely being told, so we are going on to 7 before we break. We could have a brief 15-minute break now to have the coffee. The difficulty is, obviously we're going to put in the options. My difficulty is trying to find, I don't agree with Mario, I don't agree with you. I've got some problems with option 3, because I think the code developed by the regulator, even though it's after conversation, I think they will flip with that. They will go with it. So that's my difficulty with that one. The other point I wanted to raise is now we've dropped history and art, which a number of countries have. I don't know if you looked at that. I did you look at that so much with your permission? Which sections of it? Maybe tell me now so I can look over to you. You must know the page already. No, I'm joking. But I mean, you could look at that aspect. But I'm not particularly satisfied with anything. I mean, I feel that Dean's thing is too wide. Would be my personal view. JD, I don't know, you're not saying anything, but maybe there should be further engagement with Sanet, who are not the easiest kind of people. But there needs to be something. But I'm still not satisfied. I think what you've put out, Ananda, is very useful. But I'm not sure if it helps get to a conclusion. I mean, it doesn't get us to the conclusion, I don't think. But we can break the tea and then come and start again.
One thought as well.
You will leave the common law if you want to defend your right to privacy against the newspaper and other writers. If somebody writes a book about in which he divulges the if you use the common law privacy, and that will be developed in a way that is appropriate to Russia. And this is just not the right place to use the media. It's not a sausage machine for data.
Sure, but you see, I don't have a problem. I agree with you, Dean, on a media extension. The problem is who else comes with the media extension.
It's the same ghost which keeps you chasing you over and over, Mr. Chairman, and it's the scope of application of the Act. one additional difficulty. When you're looking at the world as it is before this act, the media has got two big categories, and we all have two big categories, private and the public domain. And once it gets into the public domain and stays there for long enough, it takes a long time before it gets back to being private. And these are the two things. Here we've got a different situation, where there's something which is public, by virtue of being differently reaggregated, reorganized, manipulated, becomes private. You take the telephone book, all the telephone numbers are private, are public, but I take those numbers, I add value to the aggregation, and I call, and I put all those to our phone numbers of ANC members or DA members, and those very phone numbers, so aggregated, become private information. So this is the difficulty the journalist is going to deal with conceptually. How come it's public before, I change it around and becomes private, and I need to, when the source document is public, and all the source documents, the majority of the data we're dealing with, are, it's public information. And I will come to this later. I mean, medical records are not. Phone numbers are. And yet phone numbers are part of the public information, or what is protected. So it's very unsuited.
It really is not done work. Look, I don't think we are going to, should we try and finish this? I don't know if we are going to get this further. Your basic, your position is you don't want it here.
What is your position? Can we have your position?
I my concern about the blanket exclusion is that my fear is who else can go through that. There is all kinds of personal information on the basis of
if it's bad enough, they protect them under the law of information. If it's a privacy intrusion, yeah, the rules will start
to. And why hasn't anyone else done it?
What other countries?
Because none of us was serving under the relations breach.
You thought that if the UK did it, it wouldn't. It doesn't even crack the regulator's mind to deal with the region. It doesn't do that stuff.
Well, the UK one is fine. It's not just your clause, okay? It's undertaken with a view to the publication of any journalistic material or article material. And the data controller is a requirement here. They reasonably effective. Having regard to the particular expression important to the public interest, the freedom of expression publication would be in the public interest, so there's a requirement of public interest. And in all the circumstances, compliance with that provision is incompatible with the special
purpose.
So I'm just saying the UK one is not your one. There's a lot more, far more control on the UK one.
Yes, but
well, you know, that's the regulator. I'm talking about what the legislature is, and we are the legislature, not the regulator. Because I think the issue is that when it comes to genuine media, genuine journalism, fine, go for it. The laws of libel, defamation, whatever apply. My concern is the confusion caused by other people trying to claim to be genuine media. I'm sure they're the regulator men.
Let me focus you on that concern, if I may. Can I just... because I think that there is where the devil is, and it's the purpose. Say that I publish for general information all the telephone numbers and the bank account numbers together of all the people of South Africa. See, the purpose here is not that of infringing on privacy. It's one of making information available. Would we want that to be falling under this act? I mean, the issue of bank secrecy is a different issue. is there what we need to deal with? But, I mean, would that be a problem?
Look, well, firstly, bank accounts, obviously.
Why?
Because then people can take that information and abuse it. Not necessarily the same people. Even phone numbers. You know, somebody in a public position could decide they do not want their phone number released, given out, because otherwise they would be phoned non-stop by the public. And they want some privacy. I think it's reasonable. It doesn't always say apply to me. My phone number is, I've only got one phone number and it's open to the public, anyone can use it.
Yeah, that's not what it's called.
But other people may feel, look, they want a private number. So a journalist writes, Wendy Nolo writes, maybe it's very unfair to her, you know, if you have problems with your consumer issues, contact me, but here's a number. Now, what? Any journalistic material?
I already have custom stampede on my cell phone from workers.
No, that's
a very expensive.
One through. Of your former colleagues publishes your number. You've left them. You've let them publish it. What's your comeback? It's not just defamation. They've released your personal information.
Are you saying that it's not in a certain agenda?
What
if I found this one now? In a tricycle example, but yeah, you would, under the common law, they go to someone on the computer, but it's not from information, not privacy.
Henk, and then I think I'd scarcely then you, but.
Yeah. It's a rhetorical question, Chair, I think to a certain extent, and it follows on what you're saying, and we would like at a later stage, the conclusion of this debate, to show you something, an example of what's going to be done. But maybe just, is, for example, an advertisement in a newspaper, is that journalism?
No.
Not. I beg to differ. First of all, what is a newspaper? There is no registration for newspapers. Well, so it's a newspaper.
What they've got in the summary, I haven't got the Abusa one, is the Act does not apply to the processing of personal information for any, they've got your bank exclusion.
Hong Kong's a place where Google has been moved from. Well, they moved to.
No.
But Dean, look, yeah, I think maybe I'll look at that. But we would need to engage further. I don't know if we're going to take it any further right now.
Just one notation, because I do these things of trying to work on your mind,
yeah.
Mr. Chairman. The example you gave of the journalist, right now, Ms. Dean Smith has no entitlement to privacy. She's a public figure. If they publish her under the present law, if they publish her phone number, she has no recourse. Because you're a public figure. We have abdicated to the right of, to a large degree, I mean, if you, who you date, could, it's game fair game, etc., under the case. Under the example you gave, this bill would be breached. Now, there are two solutions. Either it would be raised down to rebuild the extension because it's constitutionally guaranteed, or the bill would be unconstitutional. So that's why I fall back on the constitutional aspects. What are constitutional rights guaranteed by the Constitution, adopted by, confirmed by the jurisprudence? Let's take them out, whatever they are now, whatever they may be developed down the road.
Okay. I mean, the one thing at the moment is, Ms. Smuts could go to the press ombudsman and present a case. Well, no, it's not an entirely fair game. It's as far as I understand it, it's a higher onus. So I don't know if the issue of personal cell phone. Okay, can we move, Ananda?
Just for interest's sake, I just want to refer you to what the ICASA Code of Conduct and the South African Press Code say at the moment, you know, what they say about privacy. It says, insofar as both news and comment are concerned, broadcasting licensees shall exercise exceptional care and consideration in matters involving the private lives and private concerns of individuals, bearing in mind that the right to privacy may be overridden by a legitimate public interest. And the current press code says, in both news and comments, the press shall exercise exceptional care and consideration in matters involving the private lives and concerns of individuals, bearing in mind that any right to privacy may be overridden only by legitimate public interest. So it's more or less the same. And I wonder this is our South African press code. And yes, but although, I mean, the British one has many sections. If you refer to that, that's just the 1A, you know, the A section. But I wonder if we use the words that they use, maybe that would be more... If we say the safeguard should include this, exactly the words that they already have in their code. This is what the safeguards, a code with sufficient safeguards that states, and we give them their own code.
Okay, so then we'll have to come back to other options, Mario and Dean's proposal. We then go to E, Cabinet Committees, the Executive Council of the Province, and the Municipal Council of a Municipality. I think the issue, the thing is, what exactly is covered by PIA? Cabinet is covered. Is the Executive Council covered?
Cabinet and its committees, chairs.
Because the why I'm asking is the Executive Council is covered by secrecy, is classified, the same as Cabinet. Whereas I don't think the Municipal Council is at all. They're the public bodies. So mine would be more, surely we should take out Municipal Council, but keep in Executive Council of the Province, because it's of the same status as Cabinet. Any disagreement on that one? I mean, you will not get any minutes of Cabinet, you will not get any minutes of a Cabinet Committee, you will not get any minutes of a Executive Council, a Provincial Cabinet.
And it's not the same as themselves,
the various MEC's departments or, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand what it is that we are doing here, because the documents are classified and it's a different story. What we're dealing with here is how certain organs, certain entities deal with and protect and process and disseminate information. By exempting cabinet, one would say that cabinet is an organ, is the executive, because that's what cabinet is the power of doing all the things that we don't want them to do, to disseminate the phone numbers, to release medical information. So a statement of cabinet would not be bound by the same constraint. This is not about protecting the confidentiality of cabinet or executive council discussions and documentation. Why should it be exempted? And then the same thing for parliament. There is no exemption of parliament, but everything we do is on the public record. So should we, when we are on the public record, when we speak, not be... Yeah, we're privileged that we can do that.
Cabinet, it would be, there's a discussion around appointments. CVs are distributed, containing incredibly personal information. Okay? It allows them, this exemption allows them to do that. And the same would apply to a provincial executive. They want to discuss, the provincial cabinet in the Western Cape wants to discuss the appointment of somebody. They circulate CVs to all MECs and discuss it in a provincial executive meeting. This exemption allows them to do that, which they should. Okay, that's I think what is being allowed. Whereas a local government, I mean, it would have to be done elsewhere, not in the full council, and it's then consistent with the PIA. I don't know why the provincial executives were not exempted from PIA. But anyway, look, I mean, do we, what do people want to say here? I would propose that we take out municipal council, but keep everything else in. Is there agreement with that, disagreement with that?
Well, what?
Mario wants to take it all out.
Well, I'm asking you a question. And if you, and if the answer doesn't come to the fore, then perhaps there is no reason to.
So you've been asking a question.
Yeah, I mean, why? I mean, what is it that we want to prevent people from doing, from disclosing personal information? So why?
We want to allow cabinet and provincial executives to process personal information in the course of their discussions, their meetings. So that personal information could be. The example I gave of CVs for considering somebody for a job, it could be...
Yeah, but each and every company does that. But then once those CVs have been processed, the obligation is to keep those CVs for as long as it is required, not to keep them for too long, to destroy them after a while, and whatever else applies to any other organ of state or to any company. Not to give all the phone numbers on those CVs out, not to give all the information on the CVs out. Why shouldn't cabinet? I mean, it seems just. I don't know whether it has been thought through. I mean, it seems a very deferential approach, just because cabinet is cabinet, that we can't legislate about cabinet. I don't see the rationale.
That's right. And answer me one other thing. This in no way suggests that the powers of parliamentarians at either the national or the provincial level are constrained in holding executive members to account, does it? I mean, that's not what it says. It says, no, cabinet and its committee. But Mario's question is right. This is not something that we kind of took over the fire without thinking it through.
No, I am thinking the main reason that cabinet would be excluded is in some instances cabinet would deal with issues of intelligence, issues of investigation, sensitive investigations. So they would process personal information in that capacity, and they are required to do that. But when it comes to releasing information, cabinet doesn't release detailed statements of that includes personal information of people that are investigated.
Yeah, but why do we need to exempt them then? You're not answering the question. Why do we need to exempt them?
To allow them to process that information in the committees.
Yeah, but that's not. That information is processed.
So I think the issue
is I would feel quite strongly that this section remains as is, with the exception of municipal council. So you've got the option then of putting in a clause of removing the entire E, or not. I don't know if you want that. Ian and Mario, you want that?
Yeah.
Mario, then you
well, it's not going to make any difference. I see that as the result of a differential mindset, as it is your not wanting to take it out. I will not do that in the first place.
Any problems with that as being exempt? And then G exempted in terms of Section 34, which is the regulated exemptions. So saying let's deal with 34, regulator may authorize processing. Okay, no problem with that. Then H, Dean.
The proposal by both the Public Service Monitor in the Eastern Cape and by AWUSA. By public bodies that are required by law to maintain public records. They both were arguing that the deeds office and CIPRO and all the others already collect and store the information under statute. And I think the archivists also argued the same thing. And that they are basically dealt with, and that whatever they gather has to be accessible to the public. It's the whole point. You must have free public access to the things that are required to be in those records. I see a lot of head shaking, so I'd like. Created by statute and under a statutory duty to hold public records, such as CIPRO and such as the Deeds Office.
No. Should they be exempted? I mean, this doesn't detract from their duty to keep those records, but why should they not keep them?
I suppose we keep publicly and for public access.
See, this is the entire difficulty that I have. Public records, do they need to be kept privately?
No.
I don't see here, it's a big exemption. They say what is public doesn't need to be dealt with. And they can't put it there because at one point, I mean, all these things are public. And it's the example of the telephone book. It is public, you reprocess the number, and it becomes private.
Except there are lots of exceptions that said if it's already public.
Around the processing of existing public information. So I think you gave the example of divorces, residential addresses, and divorces in America, and that's being ruled to be an unfair processing because
once they were put together,
because it then meant that estate agents could buy those lists and start honing in on those people for property sales. So it's not just the thing of anything that's already in the public domain, it is the issue of processing. But Christine, and I'll give to Henk and Ananda. Christine, you had your hand up? Once we finished. Okay, Henk and Ananda, who's... Oh, okay.
Look, I think it's all concerned with the principle that says you're supposed to use the information for the purpose for which it was collected. And for instance, the Leeds office would now say collect the information for purposes of knowing who owns what and, you know, filling, you know, the proper purposes of the Leeds office. But they should now decide to take that information and sell it to a direct marketer. And they use it for direct marketing of whatever, flowers. Then it's not being used for the purpose for which it was collected, and the fact is that people would be very unhappy if they are now inundated with advertising material, and that is where they got the information from the Leeds office.
That's what you do with it. Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Okay.
Probably, for now.
That already is a problem. The Department of Land Affairs are being asked by various parties to provide some of the information which they have on their databases in different forms, and the basis of that is we need that information to be able to deal with this information, let's say for property development, but in fact that information is then being re-manipulated and sold in all sorts of different areas. So that is a very good example of exactly what is happening. The information that is there for a particular purpose within the Department of Land Affairs, and that information is required legitimately in certain instances, in certain forms. But immediately, what is happening is that as soon as it's out of the deeds office, out of the department's control, it's being manipulated in different ways. And it's actively, as a matter of experience, where they've actively been asking for information, and that the department actually does the work of actually profiling that information in a particular way.
Okay, so H now then.
Out.
Okay. Christine, what did you want to talk on?
Just the exclusion of Parliament. Mm-hmm. That was something we haven't really decided on.
No.
Again, why should Parliament be excluded?
Let's clarify it. We are not excluding entities. We are excluding functions. So Parliament is a huge employer with lots of medical records, so with all... there's no reason to exclude Parliament as an entity. The legislative function takes place under the Constitution and it's absolutely free. There is freedom of speech, freedom to legislate, subject to only the rules and orders of the Assembly. So we couldn't do it here. Only the rules could do that.
That's right. That's 100% correct.
All right. We move. All right, that was then the exclusions under 4. Then 5, the savings, the view expressed earlier was that should go under 3. The 3 becomes application and interpretation. Is there anything in the existing 5 that anyone wants to talk about? Nope. Okay. 6 then, public and private. Does anybody want to raise anything about private? I mean, I've read, and it goes on to the juristic.
It does.
Yeah.
And for that reason, could I suggest, can't we say this act binds all public and private bodies? Because, I mean, if we're going to discuss the juristic thing now, I just don't understand why anybody would want to make a juristicist a bearer of personal informational private rights. I mean, you know, you must describe to me what these juristics are who are so personal. It's the people who run them or own them, they have personal privacy rights. But how does a juristic person have privacy rights? I don't get. They're not a bearer of the right. They are bound by it.
however.
Mr. Chair, may I address that, or so do you want to discuss it? The fact is that if you list all the evils that we're trying to prevent that have been discussed here, all the phone numbers given for marketing purposes, all the the email addresses given for spam purposes, all the telephone numbers given them for charges purposes, all those addresses, telephone numbers, etc., even though in the name of a company, will still be answered by a physical person, and the recipient is a physical person. So it would be a huge loophole, and I thought about this, if you just exempt from protection the juristic people, the juristic entities, because they would be allowed, you could send all the phone numbers which are registered to the name of the company, all the addresses, all the records. Why not? Yeah, but that's not the point. It's the purpose for which they've been adopted. And this is what we're trying to protect. If you get the employer locator of a large company, you get all those numbers, and they're all numbers of a company, technically speaking. But you can address all the people there.
Not the thing. I mean, 72 to, it's 84, and then it's public versus private goes on. I mean, I don't have a problem with, I bought the, I mean, look, I think we're dealing with, on public versus private, I think that's straightforward. It got used as an entry point for juristic, but I accepted the arguments on juristic. That's actually in the definition section. So again, I don't know whether we want more extensive discussion on this. Yeah, I don't know if anybody wants to say anything that's new.
The only concern that I will have at this stage, possibly, and I agree with you, something that should actually be discussed in the definition tools, because I would like to address you on something else with regards to policy. However, my concern is, it's pointed out in our judgments that it is accepted that a juristic person has the right to privacy. Right. My only concern now is, if we take juristic persons out, will we have a position of unconstitutionality on the basis of equality? Because now the juristic person will most probably have to enforce his privacy rights in terms of the common law, whereas it could have done it in terms of the act. That's my question at this stage.
We went at the stampede of ladies on the side of Yolunda,
right,
on the side of the road, or the road to Yolunda either. But let me put it this way.
And I think my question of will juristics stampede, or do they stampede?
Well, they don't have peed to stamp.
Yeah, they don't have peed to stamp.
It's the payers which is lacking. But being as it may, in terms of South African law, juristic people are entitled to protection for defamation from character. So defamation of character is within the area of privacy they are entitled to reputation. You can, if the reputation of a juristic person is adversely affected, you can bring a defamation suit, including political parties, incidentally. The Constitution tells us that human rights must apply and enforce also in respect of juristic entities to the extent that they are capable of exercising and receiving them. I don't know what the actual wording is. Yeah, that they are applicable. The right to privacy is a constitutional right. So it seems that we are forced to do that. And what Hank is saying, there would be a concern of constitutionality if we don't.
May I just add to that?
Yeah.
If you look at the definition of personal information, I mean, let's admit that 85% of that does not apply at this moment to a juristic person. But that does not mean that the position may evolve in future, that some of it may become regarded as personal information.
I was just looking at cases. Caesar?
Yeah. I do not think Jefferson, it would necessarily be unfair discrimination to exclude juristic persons, because if we're saying, I think what the court would look at would be whether the choice that is made in excluding them is rational or not, considering the rights that are protected under the Act. It doesn't take away the rights of the juristic persons to still enforce their privacy rights under the Constitution. So they will still have that protection under the Constitution, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the legislature should choose to include them under this piece of legislation. So I don't think it would be necessarily unfair discrimination to exclude them.
Under the Constitution is there and itself self-fulfilling. Why are we bothering to do this? And how do you deal with the provision of the Constitution that human rights apply to juristic people, juristic entities? Is there black and white? And that's where it's more than the equality clause, is the violation of that section that concerns me. No mistake, the overwhelming majority of companies, of legal entities, are not the big companies, are the one-person company, the two-people company, the CCs, the restaurants. That's the overwhelming majority. And there the divide between corporate and individual is very, very thin. What the company consumes is what the individual consumes often. What the company does is what the individuals working there do.
Yeah, I mean, look, as far as submissions, I don't know if you've got all the submissions, but I mean, with Credit Bureau that wanted, it was really only, according to this, only Credit Bureau that wanted, well, those are the only ones that you've referred to here. Then it was Mostert, Opperman, and SABF committees wanted both to initially apply to natural persons and the minister to applied to juristics at a later point. And then MassMart wanted the same limitations found in the Consumer Protection Act and National Credit Act, that there's an exclusion with a particular turnover. But Ananda?
I just wanted to refer to the submission. I think it was from Wim Mostert who said that, you know, maybe it should not apply, but then it can be applied at the stage when it is deemed to be applicable, you know, or something like that, so that you give the, maybe not the minister, but the regulator, perhaps the authority to stipulate that a specific section of juristic persons or whatever should be applied to them. I don't know, I just wanted to refer
to
this commission.
CISA?
Can I read you something from Prince Lou versus Van der Linde? Court judgment.
Which year?
1997.
Okay.
Paragraph 23. The court says the idea of differentiation seems to lie at the heart of equality jurisprudence in general and of Section 8, the right of all rights in particular. And then 25 says, in regard to mere differentiation, the constitutional state is expected to act in a rational manner. It should not regulate in an arbitrary manner or manifest naked differences that serve no legitimate governmental purpose. For that would be inconsistent with the rule of law and the fundamental premises of the constitutional state. The purpose of this aspect of equality is therefore to ensure that the state is bound to function in a rational manner. This has been said to promote the need for governmental action to relate to a defensible vision of public good, as well as to enhance the coherence and integrity of legislation. And then in paragraph 31, it also says that when used in the second form, Section 8.2 in the context of Section 8 as a whole, principal means that treating persons differently in a way which impairs their fundamental dignity as human beings who are inherently equal in dignity. Okay. Basically, Chairperson, what I want to take out of this is that what the court said is that the legislator can choose to differentiate as long as the differentiation is not unfair, and the choice that is made is not irrational or is not it's not capricious. It makes a choice that is valid, that it has weighed carefully, and then it has applied its mind that this is the choice that it should make. So I don't think necessarily by choosing to exclude juristic persons from the ambit of this legislation, we would be discriminating against them unfairly.
Yeah, I think the issue though, okay, what you're saying is if we want to exclude them, we can. Mm-hmm. The issue is should we? That's for me the fundamental question. And I think my concern is that you know, they do have a sphere of privacy. Maybe the one solution is what Ananda raised, but maybe take this issue out of the definitions section and allow, have a provision. I don't think it's for the regulator. It would be put it in a clause that the president would determine when it comes into effect, which would probably be on the advice of the regulator, I mean, or the minister, basically. And the categories of juristic persons could be determined by the minister by regulation.
Hmm.
I don't know how that sounds. So the there is the possibility of differential implementation. I think you don't like that.
I'm merely thinking of practical implementation. You know, it only takes one juristic person to approach the minister and ask, make me part of this act, and the minister decides too long, or the minister decides not to do it, and there's a dispute. For me, the approach is better to have them in here to the extent that it's left the courts and the regulators, or the regulator where necessary, to decide what type of personal information applies. I hear what my colleague says, we certified the bill, and I don't want to necessarily cross swords with him in public, but I would rather prefer not to respond to what has been said, but I don't think CISA proposes that it should be taken out. I think he merely said that the decision to take out will be a bit lighter.
I heard what Cesar said about the criterion for differentiation, which does not fall foul of the equality clause, and I agree. There is a reason to differentiate. You can treat different categories differently. That's not the issue to me. The issue is how do we deal, what section is the section of the Constitution that, how do we deal, not section 8, how do we deal with the next, is it 8 that says they're entitled, the entitlement of juristic people, don't have a copy of the Constitution? Is it 8? Okay. Not in point of equality, but in point of entitlement. 8-4, yes. It's an 8-4, not an 8-1 or 8-2 issue. And they have right to privacy that's established. They can be adversely affected. And perhaps we can just say this, why don't we just copy the Constitution and says this bill applies to juristic entities to the extent applicable.
We have done that, Chair, and maybe, and I would like to add another issue just for the committee to consider. Our purpose of our legislation, and you remember when we looked at that clause this morning, we said we give effect to the right to privacy. That, for me, is really the bottom line, and that is the concern that I have. I really think it's super dangerous.
A regulator does, and this one is the regulator for privacy, so he's in many ways more like the Human Rights Commission than anybody else, whose function is life in life is to, they have no powers, but their function in life is to interpret the Constitution and to utter and to be authoritative. Now this one is also a regulator with verging on the economic, so he's slightly more than the Human Rights Commission in terms of power. But perhaps we can, is it possible to write a clause requiring him to do an investigation, the regulator or her, to do an investigation after consulting stakeholders on in what circumstances, when, where, perhaps in which sector it would be appropriate to either make juristic bearers or find them. I mean, the useful function of regulators like this is that they go and look in detail, as has been said here before today, to go and look at in detail at the particular conditions and factors in a particular sector. And we could even ask them to come and report to us and make a recommendation to us after applying his mind, holding an investigatory hearing.
That is precisely the point that I wanted to address. Apart from a juristic person being defined, it's also defined as personal information. But what I wanted to mention to you, and this is, let me explain it to you this way. I don't think Clause 6 is necessary at all. because if you look at our definitions clause, it's clear. We've got a definition of public body, we've got a definition of private body. And that is the application of the Act. It's strictly speaking not necessary to have a clause like this. I'm that's my honest opinion.
But you see, legally, no,
not
necessary. Ease of reading. That's what just makes it easier. For your average person, where are they going to find whether the are they going to know to go and look at the definition? So I would personally have preferred, I mean, maybe it's what it's actually, it sort of goes on, it's just on the street, you have to get it to be active. And have it in all of the where people just reading what already is.
I agree with you, but then we must be extremely careful, because what Six says at the moment is that public bodies are responsible parties in terms of this Act and private bodies are responsible parties in terms of this Act. If we bring in now in our interpretation clause an explanation around juristic persons as well, then it's going to become a bit of a lumpy provision, because now we'll have to explain that public bodies, private bodies are responsible parties. Juristic persons are data subjects and responsible parties. So it's becoming a... We can do that for you, Chair. For the sake of user-friendliness, I'm just trying to mention that you'll see a different dimension if we start tweaking the clause.
The Act applies to public and private bodies. That's what you've got here. That could go under 3. Okay. Is there a problem, and you keep your definition of responsible party, is there a problem with saying the Act applies to natural or juristic persons?
No, there's no problem, but then we'll have to define that natural persons either as responsible parties or data subjects. Juristic persons either as responsible parties or data subjects. And I'm just concerned that it might add...
Why would you need to buy... You keep the definition clause of a person, okay, as it is, because you use the word person. Having the word person means you don't have to repeat natural and juristic. All you're doing is putting a clause in which says the Act applies to the Act. Well, you're keeping no. That was already there. You're saying that the Act applies to juristic and it's getting a bit natural persons. I was going to say non-juristic. The Act applies to juristic, natural and juristic persons.
We'll have a look at that.
Have a look at that, yes. Then, but yeah, have a look at that. Okay, so we've done 4 clauses, we've got 100 to go. All right. Then we come on to the conditions for the processing of personal information, Chapter 3, Clause 7. Do you want to get before that, Mario? Okay. Now we've still not been clear around how to where we finished earlier was to say the one option was to take out the principles in short form and have these are the principles that guide as far as interpretation, but you keep the substance of and then you put the interpretation or the application of the principles elsewhere. The question was then raised, what benefit does listing these principles actually give us apart from, does it help with interpretive value? And maybe then these all references the principle altogether. So in what we're doing now, which is from clauses 7 to 24, is let's look at the, whether there's anything that is just a principle of interpretive value that doesn't actually guide anything, and how much of it is simply conditions for the lawful processing and not necessary to be shoved under these eight separate principles. And then obviously let's look at the content of each clause. I don't know if that makes any sense. Ms. Smuts, who wants the air conditioning on, who's wrapped herself in a shawl. I can't wrap myself in a shawl. No, we'll carry on. Okay, so that's what we're trying to do now. So clause 7 then, the responsible party, so it's not necessarily going to be a principle of accountability. It would be responsible party, this is a broad one, must give effect to the ensure that the principles set out in this chapter. If we're not having any principles, this clause becomes irrelevant.
The difficulty I have with this, I am a responsible party.
Are you?
Yes.
Sorry. Put you there.
I want the chairman to protect me from the chairman. No, I've got a business. I've got, I'm a responsible party. I can only do what's on the bill. What else is this asking me to do? If there is an obligation, shall must ensure that the principles set out in this chapter and the measures that give effect to such principles are complied with. So there are two things. You've got the measures which give effect to those things, which are the provisions, I understand, and then there are the principles. So if I comply with all the measures that give effect to the principles, I'm not home free yet. I need to actually do something more, which I don't know where it is and where it's written. I mean, this is not on.
Yes, I think that the way that it is written is that, for instance, if you look at the next one, personal information must be processed lawfully in a reasonable manner. Who must do that? Who must process it lawfully? And the next one, personal information may only be processed if given the purpose for which it's adequate, relevant, and not excessive. Who must process it in that way? So that's why all of them must be done by the responsible party. So whether I don't think even if you take it out, you can say that if chapter 3 only says conditions for lawful processing, then you can say the responsible must ensure that the conditions for lawful processing are complied with. Or otherwise, you must go to each principle and then determine and say the responsible party must process personal information lawfully and in a reasonable manner. The responsible party must process personal information that is relevant. It will have to include it everywhere.
The roadmap still doesn't give us the road to anything. I mean, I'm telling you, the roadmap is as bad as the one that for 10 years they're trying to sell to Israeli and Palestinians. Just read it, Mr. Chairman, if I may ask you, is somebody who's trying to comply with this act? I take that this is not comment on my... And here I am. And I accept the three provisions must be read together. You read the first one, and what's in here is not sufficient, there is something more. Then you go to the next one, and it says you need to act unlawfully and in a manner which is reasonable and doesn't infringe on the right of privacy of the data subject. You look for the right of privacy, and it's nowhere. There is no right of privacy. So something that is in the Constitution is there. Then you get to the next one. Personal information may only be processed if given to the purpose for which it's processed. It's adequate, relevant, and non-excessive. The only thing that this really could mean to me is that I must behave in terms of this act. All these three things, principles, the only thing that I can translate them with is that I must process information is provided for in terms of this act, and that's it. So if there is something more that I need to do, please tell me. I want to know, and it needs to be expressed. Let's increase on the bill, but don't force me into a case work. That you can do that with the regulator. So if these are principles that go to them, to direct the discretion of the regulator, that's fine, because then it will be implemented in the code of conduct. But because these words are to apply to me, I, as a CPA, in my legal ignorance, I cannot translate these three sections in anything but complying with the Act. And if that's what we mean, let's say it. If there is something more, tell me what it is.
Insofar as Section 7 is concerned and the responsible party, I mean, I think that if one looks at the definition as well, it's the issue of accountability. Who is accountable for the actual processing of this information? And the definition of the responsible party tells you that it's somebody who has control over, or is, I can't remember the exact definition, but essentially the point is that with information can be controlled by different people within that chain of information. And my understanding of the way that section has been written is just to make it clear who's actually accountable for the processing of information. I don't know whether I wasn't quite following.
And that's the definition of responsible party. Yeah. I've got a company, three people, I'm the guy in charge, I meet the definition of responsible party, and I'm the responsible party. Now, the issue is, I'm the responsible party, I fall under the obligation.